Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading some interesting articles from the October 2021 issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. Special delivery. Specialty foods from the West. CNI editors order in, eat up, and recommend their favorites. Maybe you've heard the French expression amuse-bouche, which literally translates, it amuses the mouth, a delicious tidbit of a term that English speakers adopted years ago as a word for appetizers. This linguistic treat comes to mind as a UPS truck bearing mail-ordered goat cheese is making its way to my address. For a couple of days, I've been getting updates about my order from Laura Chennell in Sonoma, California, when it shipped, when it was out for delivery, and when the truck was entering my neighborhood. Now I'm watching in real time a map that shows a cartoony little truck nearing my house with a treasure trove of artisanal cheeses. I'm slightly embarrassed to admit that the thought alone of this booty being deposited on my porch in all its freezer-packed glory made me salivate. I will be amusing my bush very soon. This was not a hard assignment, combing the West for the best in mail-order specialty foods, canvassing friends and fellow staffers and internet eaters, and then sampling just as many items as we could. No hazard pay necessary. It was especially not a burden to be able to do this during a pandemic, when just getting normal groceries at your local store could feel like foraging after the apocalypse. So let's tear into it together, shall we? Fresh from the farm, Laura Chennell, award-winning goat cheeses and yogurt, Sonoma, California. You could call her story for the love of goats. Setting, bucolic Sonoma County in Northern California. Time, 1979. Basic plot, Laura Chennell hasn't figured out her direction in life. She's been working and traveling in Europe, New York, and the San Francisco Bay Area for a decade and wants to get back to her home turf to live a self-sufficient life off the land. She likes goats and acquires a few. She becomes attached to them and the herd grows. She doesn't want to waste the milk. She starts making farmstead goat cheese using techniques she learned in France. Soon, word is out with influential Bay Area chefs like Alice Waters of Chez Panisse, and a new chapter in American cheese is written. Today, Laura Chennell embodies its founding namesake's pioneering spirit as a leading producer of fresh and aged goat cheeses and goat yogurts crafted with fresh goat's milk from family farms in the American West. Fan favorites, Original Log, Orange Blossom Honey Log, Everything Bagel Chablis, Creamy Brie. Fun facts. Laura Chennell thyme and rosemary marinated goat cheese is the original marinated flavor developed by Laura herself in the early 80s. To this day, a team member hand selects and individually places each bay leaf into every tub. The super versatile marinated goat cheese line can be spread on a baguette, top a salad, or garnish a soup. The infused oil can be used as a marinade or dressing. Brushed on cut tomatoes before roasting. Dip bread in the jalapeno chili oil or drizzle it over salmon. There are more serving suggestions and pairings on the website. To order or buy, laurachennell.com and from purveyors of fine cheeses. Raised at the ranch, the Perini Ranch, meets rubs, coffee, cookbooks, and more. Steakhouse and Ranch in Buffalo Gap, Texas. When we sent a short note to Tom and Lisa Perini's team asking about that beef tenderloin, they knew just what we meant. Perini Ranch's mesquite smoked peppered beef tenderloin is fully cooked, medium rare, more tender than you could imagine, and shipped off to fervent fans all over the place to be thawed out and enjoyed. With little to no effort, you have your menu's centerpiece and all the glory bestowed upon you by guests. We had to ask the Perinis about the origin and evolution of their famous mail order tenderloin. Read on for their thoughts. When did you begin offering the tenderloin for mail order, and what inspired the decision to make it available that way? Perini Ranch's mesquite smoked peppered beef tenderloin was discovered in 1995 by the New York Times. Long story short, in conjunction with our first invitation to cook at the prestigious James Beard House in New York City, we sent a tenderloin, blindly, to the New York Times in hopes of receiving media attention. Funny, maybe we were the first ones to send media kits. About 2 months later, a research editor called and asked for another tenderloin. Unbeknownst to us, the New York Times was hosting a contest for the best mail-order gift of the year. And, with good fortune, the Perini Ranch beef tenderloin was entered into the contest. A few weeks later, we received a call fact-checking the product and requesting an 800 number for our small cook shack located on the ranch, but they couldn't tell us why. The next day, the story appeared naming our mesquite-smoked peppered beef tenderloin as the mail-order gift of the year. The real catch is, we didn't have a mail-order company, but we started one real quick. What have been some of the highlights over the years regarding the dish? More accolades and honors than we could ever have dreamed, but what we really love is when a family calls from somewhere in the U.S. and tells our team, it just wouldn't be a holiday without Perini Ranch's beef tenderloin. That really makes the day. We want to be a part of our customers' family traditions and memories. Has having the tenderloin offered on Gold Belly increased the demand? How has its popularity changed the trajectory of Perini's business? We first met with Gold Belly during a trip to New York pre-pandemic lockdown. We appreciate their efforts to increase the voices of other fellow hospitality owners. They were a great partner during the pandemic, offering a new platform for discovery to new Perini Ranch fans. Perini Ranch fans are loyal, and our hope is that our new fans who found us through Gold Belly continue to come back for holidays to come. What are some other items that can be paired with it for the ultimate Perini spread? Fan favorites include a few of our signature dishes, including green chili hominy and sourdough bread pudding with whiskey sauce never disappoints. We have enjoyed reaching new tables when people couldn't travel. We do not see that trend changing, so more to come soon on additional mail order items. To order or buy, periniranch.com and goldbelly.com. By the Bottle, Ghostwood Distilling Company, blended bourbon whiskey out of Bozeman, Montana. Some basic bottle facts regarding Ghostwood blended bourbon. It's 90 proof, made from 4 premium grains, barrel matured, and never aged for less than 4 years. The folks there recommend pairing it with the stories you'll share by the light of a campfire on a dark autumn night. But it's just about right for any situation that calls for a moment of whiskey bliss. The pepper and spices give it a surprisingly smooth taste, just enough of a kick. Oh, and as far as whiskey goes, it definitely works. We speak from experience. GhostwoodWhiskey.com. Gold Belly. peruse what's on offer through Goldbelly's online curated marketplace of regional and artisanal foods, and you'll realize just how apropos that name is. Indulge your taste buds and order from amazing local food purveyors, restaurants, bakeries, delis, from all 50 states. With shipping, all that serious yum can get pricey, but when you see what delectables can be delivered to your door from around the West, you'll probably pony up. Pulled pork pierogies from Baba and Pops in Colorado, and bullwhip kelp and piri piri hot sauce from Barnacle Foods in Alaska. Trash can nachos from Guy Fieri and Hatch green chili corn chowder from Flying Star Cafe in New Mexico. Yes, please. Goldbelly.com. Expertly crafted. Truff. Truffle-based pasta sauces, hot sauces, oils, and mayos. Offices in Austin, Texas, made in Huntington Beach, California. If there's such a thing as the secret sauce, this might be it. And the secret here turns out to be truffles. You know, that pungent underground fungus slash delicacy that looks like a weird potato and is sniffed out, especially in France, by specially trained dogs or pigs. You can thank founders Nick Gillen and Nick Ajluni for sniffing out a winning recipe using truffles and then building a business from the Instagram handle for their popular food and lifestyle blog, At Sauce. With the release of their first hot sauce in 2017, they went viral, and now Truff is the number one best-selling hot sauce on Amazon and at Whole Foods. And to think that the guys initially got to know each other while competing in business competitions in college, and then saw their brand become the fastest-growing company in the hot sauce space. With its distinctive flavor profile, wow, what is that flavor? Over-the-top packaging, truffle-inspired cap, and of course, the coveted Instagram account, At Sauce, is so much more delicious and addictive than your average guilty pleasure. Fan favorites, signature black truffle hot sauce, spicy black truffle mayonnaise, black truffle pomodoro pasta sauce, and black truffle oil. Fun facts. The founders spent a year and a half testing more than 300 iterations to arrive at a winning recipe for their original sauce. The brand has been recognized on Oprah's Favorite Things twice. To order or buy, Truff, T-R-U-F-F, all in caps, .com, or Amazon, or Whole Foods. Sweetly curated. Mary's Mountain Cookies. Traditional, gourmet, and ice cream-filled cookies. Fort Collins, Colorado. After tragedies led her to leave her home state of Michigan, Mary Johns got back on her feet by getting on the back of a horse. She made a life for herself and her two children in Colorado. She also made cookies. While working at Cherokee Park Ranch in the northern reaches of Colorado, near the Wyoming border, Mary developed her Dude Ranch skills and her mountain-style cookies. People loved the cookies so much they couldn't get enough, and Mary was finally convinced her creations were truly something special. They turned out to be special enough to grow into a sweet national chain. Fan favorites. There are more than 25 varieties and flavors, but we especially love s'mores, snickerdoodle, chocolate chip, caramel sea salt, and the buttercream cookie sandwiches. There are gluten-free cookies and homemade ice cream sandwiches, too. Fun facts. Edible cookie dough. And check out Mary's story and cookbook for recipes and her uplifting stories of overcoming adversity. to order or buy. Phone number 970-226-9091. marysmountaincookies.com, and in person at the original Fort Collins location in the Front Range Village, and other locations in Colorado, Wyoming, Texas, Montana, Indiana, and South Dakota, with more coming soon. The Sweetgrass Trading Company. It could be called Indigenous Bounty, but Sweetgrass Trading Company has a more poetic ring. A subsidiary of the Ho-Chunk Trading Group of the Winnebago Tribe of Nebraska, Sweetgrass curates a selection of traditional Native American food products and handcrafted items from across Indian country on its wide-ranging website. In the Department of Authentic Native American Food and Beverage, you'll find products like Tanka Bars from the Oglala Lakota on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, and based on traditional wasna and pemmican. The bars evoke a wellness philosophy in both name, B. Tanka means to live life powerfully, and in ingredients, which combine high-protein, prairie-fed buffalo and tart sweet cranberries, and come in slow-smoked original, apple, orange peel, and spicy pepper. You'll also find everything from wild rice and wild rice pancake mix, Passamaquoddy maple amber maple syrup, and Red Lake Nation wild chokecherry syrup, to smoked wild salmon chowder, Yaupon Brothers American tea, sustainably harvested in the pristine forests of Florida East Coast, and gift boxes for all of us who can't begin to make up our minds. It's all the more satisfying when you know that a portion of the proceeds goes to a Ho-Chunk Native Scholarship Program. SweetgrassTradingCompany.com. When you climb with this veteran rock jock, you can be sure you'll end up knowing your butte from your backside. Rocking It in Utah with Kitty Calhoun. I drive my rented red Chevy Cruze as deep into Bear's Ears as it will go. When the rocks and ruts get too big in the National Monument in southeast Utah, I park. Kitty Calhoun, who has guided ice, rock, and alpine climbs across the world for 4 decades, grabs her pack stuffed with snacks and water, and sets off for a trail that will take us to the Citadel Ruins, a rock formation with an ancient Pueblo ruin built into its side. We hike along the top of Road Canyon. Across the canyon to our left, horizontal lines in the red brick rock look like a child's attempt to put icing on the side of a cake. Green desert plants dot the cake like candy decorations. Beyond the canyon, the two buttes that give Bear's Ears its name dominate the landscape. Calhoun glides atop the uneven terrain like a dancer, as if the rocks and ledge and cacti that will grab my ankles in 3 days will be spending hiking and scrambling, and rock climbing in Utah aren't there. We shimmy down between two boulders, shuffle through a crevice, and emerge into slick rock. We make a U-turn and walk along a shelf just below where we were moments ago. Now the canyon drops off to our right. We know we're close to the Citadel, but a knob of rocks obscures our view. Calhoun turns right around the knob and stops. She makes a noise that sounds like a cheer and a gasp put together. When I turn the corner, she's almost dancing. We've found the Citadel, and it is spectacular. Rising behind her, it climbs into the sky like a rock castle built by an ancient giant. Many landmarks in Utah have ominous-sounding names: Goblin's Lair, Hell's Revenge, Satan's this and that, etc. At least the Citadel's name makes sense.
It looks like a citadel God made out of the rocks he had lying around. A land bridge leads out to it, an epic red carpet daring us to walk across. Now I can't keep up with Calhoun. She climbs up and over ledges and darts away as if she can't wait to see every inch of it. Over 40 years into her climbing career, Calhoun, who turns 61 this year, still loves to reach new heights, to see new beauty, to lose herself in new adventures. She sees the awesome in everyday nature, like the chirping of birds or the changing of the leaves. She gets overwhelmed when nature is showing off, like it does with the citadel. "This is so cool," she says, her smile as wide as the canyon behind her. "Not your average trail, huh?" And she's not your average guide, either. Calhoun grew up a self-described Southern Belle in South Carolina. When she was a teenager, she wanted to hike the Appalachian Trail, a 2,190-mile ribbon of dirt that runs from Georgia to Maine. Her mom wouldn't let her, so Calhoun signed up for an Outward Bound class instead. The class planted in her a love of challenging herself that still drives her. Sports Illustrated called her indefatigable and one of the world's most accomplished alpine climbers, and that was 27 years ago. Indeed, had sport climbing been an Olympic sport then, as it was for the first time when the Summer Games were held in Tokyo this year, it seems like a safe bet that she'd have a wall full of medals. She has taught climbing to Navy SEALs and nervous newbies and everyone in between. Calhoun splits time between Utah, where she rock climbs in the summer, and Colorado, where she ice climbs in the winter. We run into friends of hers from the climbing world deep in Bear's Ears, and again at the Thai restaurant in Moab. When I tell this to her son, Grady, he shrugs. "My mom knows everybody," he says. Before I flew to Utah, Calhoun and I talked on the phone several times to hash out the details. She emailed me to say she'd bring water, dinner, breakfast, coffee, cream, sugar, pots, pans, a camp chair for me, etc. Basically, everything except my notebook. And she probably has one of those in her pack, too. She considers her climbs, whether they're in Utah or Nepal, on a new track or one she's done 100 times. Team efforts in which the group works together to share the experience. And that's true if she's climbing as a guide or with friends. She's a good partner because she's supportive, says Don Glank, a veteran guide who has climbed with Calhoun many times, including 3 trips to Iceland, where she posted numerous first ascents. She values the fact you're climbing together, so you share the experience together. It's a partnership. That's quite nice, actually, and kind of rare. Calhoun's fellow climbers describe her as driven, single-minded, and goal-oriented. All traits her accomplishments verify, but her personality does not. She's way more laid back than all that, and comes across more like a surfer dropped into the mountains than a type A personality bent on getting ever higher. Still, that easy manner masks an insatiable drive to get better, even 40 years into her career. When she sets a goal, scale this pitch, ascend this route, find this ruin, she doesn't stop until she achieves it, no matter the terrain or obstacles in her way. She emerged as a force in a male-dominated sport, she says, because she was blessed with a lot of male climbing mentors. I think the climbing world was an early adopter of DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. Calhoun has won grants and sponsorships and has been hired as a guide by prestigious organizations such as Outward Bound and the American Alpine Institute. With three other women, she is co-owner of a business called Chicks Climbing and Skiing, for whom she guided for years before she became part owner in 2015. Under her picture on the group's website, it says simply, Legend. The highly acclaimed all-female guides teach rock, ice, and alpine climbing, and backcountry skiing. Chicks turned 20 in 2019, and Calhoun helped produce a video and roundtable discussion to look back at how far it has come and look forward to what's next for women in adventure sports. She thinks often about what's next for her, both in climbing and in life. In climbing, the answer, or one of them at least, is simple, if also surprising. She wants to get better at falling in rock climbing. There is no real danger in it. She knows the ropes will catch her. Still, every time she slips, her heart skips a beat. I haven't gotten used to the cheap thrill. It's still scary for me, she says. If I were to practice it, I would become comfortable with it. In life, the answer to what's next is more complicated. The day after we hike to the Citadel, we descend deep into Sheik's Canyon to see a series of Native American pictographs, especially one known as Green Mask, because that's what it looks like. The area has been inhabited dating back 8,500 years, and many different cultures are represented in the artifacts and pictographs they left behind. On the way, I'm distracted by the massive, audacious, in-your-face beauty of Grand Gulch, an unending canyon with tan, red, and brown shelves, and also by the tiny, exquisite, subtle details of the desert floor, populated by countless flowers, miniature explosions of yellow, purple, and white. Watching the scenery instead of where I'm going, I slip on slick rock and almost fall into a ravine. Don't hike like you drive, Calhoun jokes. I deserve that. We've driven for hours around Utah the last 2 days, and more than once I nearly ran off the road because I was gaping at Devil's Desert or Beelzebub's backwater or Lucifer's landmass and not watching the road. Okay, I admit I made up those names, but oh, the irony of putting her in danger by something as simple as driving. Calhoun has so many stories of almost dying on mountains that I'm not sure which one to tell. She has survived avalanches and impassable crevasses, and 8 days hanging from a mountain on the rough equivalent of a window washer's platform. Once, she almost starved when someone stole the 40 Snickers bars she had buried in the snow. Who steals 40 Snickers buried in the snow? That was one of many questions Calhoun asked herself when she tried to retrieve those cached Snickers, along with other food and fuel during an ascent of Alaska's Denali, the tallest mountain in the United States. Curiously, the thief mercifully left the rest of the food and the fuel, and Calhoun thought she and her hiking partner had enough of both to finish their climb without the precious calories the Snickers would have provided. But as they neared the summit, a storm roared over the top of Denali and pinned them down. The blizzard lasted 1 day, then another, then 3 more. They ran out of food. For 5 days, they could not move from the spot they had chipped out of the ice, and they had only enough fuel to melt snow to drink 2 cups of water each per day. When the storm finally cleared, Calhoun was so exhausted she could barely strap the crampons onto her boots. She and her climbing partner managed to scramble over the top of Denali and then climb down to their second cache of food on the other side. That drop, thankfully, had been left undisturbed by hungry thieves. Every time she goes up a mountain, she comes down changed, that time more than ever. "I gained a freedom of understanding of what I can do without," Calhoun says, "and a greater appreciation of what I have." What she has, a life rich in experience, and what she has given away have been much on her mind as the prime of her climbing career has ended and the next phase of it has begun. "Do you ever feel guilty about how your life turned out?" Calhoun asks me as we await outside of a Thai restaurant after emerging from Bear's Ears. She was really asking about herself. What did she do to deserve the career she has had? And what has she done with it? She sometimes feels as if she might be selfish, a tension that she has wrestled with for years. She spent 7 years living out of her car so she could chase every mountain that called to her. She owned 2 pairs of socks, 2 pairs of pants, and 2 sweaters, and got by on $14 a week for food. "I would have been a cheap date," she says. Through much of her career, she focused only on the next great climb. That made it possible for her to become an incredible climber. But she has tried in recent years to move beyond just being a great climber, to find balance between climbing and life. She got married, had a son, divorced, remarried. Her husband Jay is an accomplished climber and guide also. Became co-owner of Chicks, and yet she has never been far from the mountains. Now she wants to climb with a purpose beyond herself. "There's a bigger world out there than just how hard I can climb," she says. As co-owner of Chicks, she passes on what she knows to other women who absorb it and pass it on to still more. And she has become more politically aware. She is particularly interested in climate change. Some of her climbs have become last ascents because shifts in weather have made them impassable. "She took me to Bear's Ears because it's beautiful and she wanted to immerse herself in it. But she has another reason too, the constant threat of development on public lands. Imagine," she says, as we emerge from trees to a wide open view of Road Canyon, "if there were oil rigs over there." On our last day in Bear's Ears, I wake up early in my tent. I make a cup of coffee and wander downhill away from our campsite. I carefully watch where I put my feet to avoid cacti and shift my shoulders and hips to avoid the junipers and pines that dot the landscape. After a few hundred feet, I stop. If there's a place and a moment that can help me understand how Calhoun could guide climbs for 4 decades and still get excited about each one, this is it. The desert sand cushions each step. The wind whispers against my skin, a soft touch cool with the last vestiges of the night still lingering in the air. Animal prints follow an elusive trail, or maybe make their own. Far ahead of me in the distance, the Bear's Ears buttes poke into the sky. To my right, the sun peeks over Road Canyon. As it rises, I hear a strange noise like a cross between crackling fire and popcorn. I try to pinpoint its origin. After a few minutes of following the noise, I'm baffled to discover it's coming from all around me. The junipers and pines are making it. If trees could applaud the sun, this is what it would sound like. Are the Bear's Ears listening too? When Calhoun rose out of her tent, I call her over. "Listen to that," I say. She leans in toward a juniper. She looks at me in amazement, her expression asking, "What the?" She has never heard that sound before. And with the same expression that crossed her face when she first saw the citadel, she beams with joy.
Hello, this is Michael. I'm reading articles from True West Magazine, November 2021 edition. Own a Gunfighter's Favorite by Phil Spagenberger. Thanks to replicas, you can have a spitting image working copy of some of the Old West's most colorful shootists' famous guns. Talk about expensive. Original guns used by the famous and infamous personalities of the Old West have become coveted collectibles. If not already in museum collections, such arms can cost 5, 6, and sometimes 7 figures, making them impossible for anyone of average means to afford. In the Rock Island Auction Company's May 2021 auction, two notable 5.5-inch barreled 1873 Colt Peacemakers garnered hefty prices. A Colt single-action SA used by the Dalton Gang in Coffeyville, Kansas, dual bank robbery, sold for $138,000. And the last Colt SA personally ordered by Frontier gunfighter W.B. Bat Masterson hammered down a whopping $488,750. Recently, Bonhams of Los Angeles auctioned off the 7.5-inch barreled Colt 4440 SA that Sheriff Pat Garrett used to kill Billy the Kid for an astounding $6,030,312. A Springfield sporting rifle buried with James Butler Wild Bill Hickok went for $425,312. Robert Olinger's shotgun went for $978,312. John Wesley Hardin's Smith & Wesson sold for $625,312. And another Bat Masterson Colt sold for $375,312. Obviously, purchasing an actual gun owned by a notable Western figure is out of the question for most of us. It's believed that James Butler Hickok, known as the Prince of Pistoliers and shown here with his percussion navies, carried cartridge conversion Navy Colts in his final days. In Uberti USA's Outlaws and Lawmen series, this Wild Bill replica, a 7.5-inch 38 special, octagon-barreled 1851 Navy clone, is offered. This handsome six-shooter sports a blue and color case hardened finish and simulated ivory stocks, similar to what Hickok would have packed. Photo of Wild Bill, 38, courtesy of Uberti USA Hickok. Photo from True West Archives. The following replica firearms are detailed copies of famous shooting irons used by the gunmen of the Wild West. For the sake of brevity, we'll focus strictly on metallic cartridge firearms. A number of firearms companies offer historic reproduction firearms. Outfits like Taylor's and Company and Dixie Gunworks offer an extensive line of frontier-era revolvers, rifles, and shotguns. C. Sharp's Arms Company custom builds 1874, 1875, and 1877 Sharps, 1885 Highwall, and Remington Hepburn rifles. Winchester offers new versions of its legendary 1866, 1873, 1886, 1892, 1894, and 1895 lever-action rifles, along with its 1885 single-shot Highwall rifle. And Marlin continues to turn out its long-popular model 1894 and 1895 lever guns. Ruger, of course, produces its much-like Vaquero single-action Peacemaker-style revolver with its traditional looks and modern internal workings. For this article, we're focused on replicas of the actual guns toted by historical figures. Among the guns carried by lawman, Army Scout gambler William Barclay Bat Masterson was a 5.5-inch ivory-stocked, nickeled, and engraved 45 Colt Peacemaker. Cimarron Firearms offers a laser-engraved old-model copy of Bat's original revolver. It features the circular bullseye ejector head, a squared-off front blade sight, and the name W.B. Bat Masterson laser-engraved on the back strap, like on the famed gunman's original. Despite being fitted with the pre-1896 black powder frame, Cimarron's Bat Masterson's repro handles modern factory smokeless ammo. Masterson photo from True West Archives, replica revolver courtesy Cimarron Firearms. Revolvers. Cimarron Firearms has a few 1873 Colt lookalikes designed to resemble the guns of legendary gunmen. They boast of laser engraving that is not as detailed as hand engraving, but neither is the price tag. Cimarron's Bat Masterson revolver is patterned after one of the famed Lawman Army Scout Gambler's Colts. The 5.5-inch barreled nickeled six-shooter is an old model pre-1896 black powder frame. Handles 45 Colt factory smokeless ammo, like Bat's 1880s peacemakers, and sports a 5.5-inch barrel, a squared-off front sight blade, circular bullseye ejector head, simulated ivory stocks, and like the original, wears W.B. Bat Masterson engraved on the back strap. Cimarron's copy of Cowboy President Teddy Roosevelt's 1880s nickeled 7.5-inch barreled Colt with the TR monogram on faux ivory stocks is also offered with laser engraving and is a real beauty. Both Cimarron and EMF Company offer handsome replicas of General George S. Patton's famed peacemaker. While General Patton is usually associated with World War II, this fighting general made quite a name for himself during the 1916 punitive expedition in Mexico. As a young lieutenant out on a foraging patrol, Patton surprised three Mexican revolutionaries from Pancho Villa's Brigada del Norte and, in a gun battle, shot each of the banditos and emerged as unscathed victor. Patton was credited with wounding all three and killing two of them with his 1873 Colt revolver. He went on to become one of the Second World War's most successful generals and packed this famous peacemaker throughout the war. Cimarron's version is nickel-plated in the post-1896 pre-war style, cylinder-based pin retaining screws on each side of the frame, and is laser-engraved in the Kuno Helfrich style of Colt engraving, as was the general's sidearm. It's produced in 45 Colt with the 4 3/4-inch barrel, has hand-fitted poly ivory grips with the GSP initials, and a lanyard ring on the grip frame. EMF's deluxe General Patton copy is part of its Great Western II series of 1873 single-action revolvers. Its tribute to Patton is a handsome stainless steel pre-war model, correct 4 3/4-inch barrel, and is offered in either the 45 Colt chambering or in 357 Magnum. It sports factory laser engraving in the style of Patton's original Colt and wears simulated plain ivory grips. Uberti USA has created the Outlaws and Lawmen series, made to emulate those revolvers of the good and bad men of the West. It includes such six-shooters as Frank, a 7.5-inch barreled, nickeled 1875 Remington model, one of Frank James's favorite sidearms. It's offered in 45 Colt, 38 Special, or 357 Magnum. The Teddy model is a 5.5-inch tubed 73 Cattleman SA, featuring engraving similar to a Colt, our cowboy president Theodore Roosevelt, owned in his later years. It too comes in 45 Colt, 38 Special, or 357 Magnum. The Prince of Pistoliers, James Butler Hickok, was believed to have carried cartridge conversion Colts in his final days, and Uberti's series includes the Wild Bill 7.5-inch 38 Special octagon-barreled 1851 Navy replica that sports faux ivory stocks like other guns Hickok was known to have. This writer's favorite of the Uberti lineup is the Dalton, a blue and color case-hardened, laser-engraved, peacemaker-styled SA, fitted with faux ivory stocks. It copies one of the 45 Colts used by the Dalton gang during their ill-fated Coffeyville, Kansas, dual bank robbery. It's available as a 45 Colt, 38 Special, or 357 Magnum. Other smoke wagons in the Outlaws and Lawmen series include revolvers simulating weapons packed by gambler gunfighter Doc Holliday and outlaws Billy the Kid, Jesse James, and John Wesley Hardin. Rifles. Some of the most coveted treasures from our Western past are shoulder arms. Cimarron offers a selection of rifles that are copies of the long arms that played major roles in conquering the Wild West. A trio of 32-inch octagon-barreled Billy Dixon Sharps replicate the model 1874 Sharps Sporting Rifle, like Dixon used during the June 1874 battle at Adobe Walls in Texas, when he dropped an Indian warrior from 1,538 yards, 7/8 of a mile. These repros include two Pedersoli-made rifles, 4590 and 4570, and a more economically priced Army Sport version, 4570. Each model duplicates the look of the Hartford model 74 Sharps with the metal nose cap and a blue and color case hardened finish. Even though buffalo hunter Matthew Quigley was not a genuine Old West frontiersman, actor Tom Selleck's portrayal of the sharpshooter brought him life beyond the screen. His co-star, the 1874 Sharps rifle, produced by the Shiloh Rifle Manufacturing Company, was expressly crafted for the 1990 classic Quigley Down Under film, and together the pair has become modern-day Wild West icons. Shiloh continues to custom-build Quigley Sharps replicas, down to the last detail of the movie gun, including the customer's initials, any initials except MQ, in gold inlaid on the receiver. If you want a buffalo gun that shoots 1,200 yards, or in Quigley's words, one that shoots a mite further, contact Shiloh. Speaking of movies, the 1980 Western Tom Horn, starring Steve McQueen, gave rise to an interest in the big 1876 Winchester lever-action rifle. Cimarron has brought out a recreation of the blue frame 76 packed by McQueen, including a replica of the unique tang sight, similar to that seen on the silver screen rifle. This 45-60 caliber level gun, as featured in the flick, also has a side plate with a facsimile of Horn's actual signature engraved on it. One of Cimarron's many unique and historical introductions to the replica world is its 22-inch barreled, full-stocked, round-barreled 1876 Winchester NWMP carbine. This is a spitting image of those 1,261 Winchester 76s issued to Canada's Northwest Mounted Police, who saw service from 1878 until 1914. Chambered for the powerful 45-75 cartridge, these lever actions were used to put down the 1885 Northwest Rebellion, protect Canada's borders during the Yukon Gold Rush of 1898, and later during the Alaska boundary dispute at the dawn of the 20th century. Cimarron's detail-perfect copy features a full blue finish, tubular magazine, full stock with barrel band and blue metal forend, with the addition of the proper NWMP stamping on the stock. This model is chambered for the original 45-75 350 grain bullet cartridge. Cimarron also offers the 1876 carbine in the crossfire version, as featured in the popular 2001 Tom Selleck TNT movie Crossfire Trail. This civilian model, available in 45-75 or 45-60 movie version, sports a blue barrel, magazine, barrel band, and metal forend, but has a color case-hardened receiver, lever, trigger, hammer, and butt plate. Although Henry Repeating Arms is perhaps best known for producing modern designs of lever-action rifles inspired by the repeaters of the Old West, the company also offers a selection of authentic, all-American-made Model 1860 Henry rifles. Henry's full-length historic replica rifle has a 24.5-inch blue octagon barrel and comes in a choice of brass, 44-40 or 45 Colt, or iron, color case hardened, receiver, 4440 only, and butt plate. A 20.5-inch 4440 octagon-tubed carbine model is also offered with brass receiver and butt plate and two limited production of 1,000 each, brass or silver, engraved 1860 design Henry. 4440 full-length rifles are offered. Each of the engraved models is hand-engraved and embellished, as were those presented to dignitaries and or purchased as presentation pieces during the 1862 to 1866 period of the original Henry's production. Henry also offers a special 200th anniversary, limited to 200 copies, engraved original style Henry rifle, commemorating the birth of this historic gun's inventor, Benjamin Tyler Henry. Shooters wanting a more modern style Old West lever action rifle should remember that Henry Repeating Arms carries a broad selection of dozens of rimfire and centerfire lever guns, ranging from 22 rimfire to 44 Magnum, and even 4570 chamberings. The newest additions to its lineup include the side gate lever actions in a variety of models and finishes. These side gate rifles allow for loading through the removable tubular magazine or via a more traditional lever gun side plate loading. Of course, since you can enjoy shooting these historic replicas, you'll need fodder. Besides standard factory loadings, there are outfits that turn out Old West ammunition and or the reduced velocity cowboy loads, ranging from small bore revolver chamberings up to the big rifle rounds. Check out the cowboy action offerings from Aguila, Black Hills Ammunition, Buffalo Arms, Fiocchi, HSM, MagTech, Tennessee Cartridge Company, and Winchester. Some of these firms even offer black powder ammo. Garrett Cartridges, which specializes in super hard cast hammerhead hunting loads, also offers a nifty 4570 420 grain Springfield load, moving out at 1,300 feet per second, especially made for trap doors and replicas. Remember, these replicas of the actual guns of the famed gunmen and organizations of the frontier are more than just wall hangers. They're fun working guns that you can enjoy for plinking, competition, or taking game with. Grab a recreated piece of history and relive the Wild West. Phil Spangenberger has written for Guns and Ammo, appears on the History Channel and other documentary networks, produces Wild West shows, is a Hollywood gun coach and character actor, and is True West's firearms editor. And now here's the column by Marshall Trimble. Rattlesnakes, Renegades, and UFOs. Published October 2021. Were Wayne Rizell involved in the killing of Pat Garrett and Mike Rizell involved in the 1947 Roswell UFO incident related? True West Maniac number 697, Mansfield, Ohio. I reached out to award-winning author historian Heidi Osler, who has done a lot of research on the Rizells. Yes, Mac and Wayne Rizell were related. Wayne's father was the brother of Mac's grandfather. Those Rizell brothers were great pals with Oliver M. Lee, W.W. Cox, Albert Fall, and that whole group who were involved with range wars, feuds, charged with attempted murder, and other fun stuff. And of course, those men are believed to have been behind Pat Garrett's assassination. How prevalent were no carry laws in the Old West? Jeff Arnold, Indio, California. Those old check your weapon laws were put into place in frontier towns for a good reason, and that was to keep the drunks from killing each other for no reason. They could settle an argument with their fists if they didn't mind getting bruised knuckles. If a lawman used the barrel of his Colt to buffalo a drunk, locking him up for the night and giving him a small fine was much better than shooting him. But most of those laws were local. Western states with a lot of wide open spaces couldn't enforce no carry in places where guns were absolutely necessary for protection, hunting for food, etc. Many of those photos you see of gun-toting cowboys are studio photos, and the pistols aren't loaded. Cowboys love to get fancy duds on, pack smoke wagons, and have their photo taken. In my research of Old West figures, I've frequently read he, she was buried in a certain place year and then reinterred in so-and-so cemetery. How often did that happen? Mark Laveras, Highlands Ranch, Colorado. That happened quite frequently and still does. It usually happens when a man, woman, or child dies far from home and the family wishes to have them buried in a local cemetery. It also happened with soldiers killed in action. I had a friend shot down over North Vietnam in 1967. His body wasn't recovered until just a few years ago. The remains were reburied with full military honors in the Arlington National Cemetery in Virginia. There may be few remains, but any amount at all still gives a family closure. What was General George Crook's General Order Number 10? Sean Coate, Fort Fairfield, Maine. General George Crook's General Order Number 10 on November 21st, 1871, declared that all roving bands of Apache Indians are required to go upon their reservations by February 15, 1872. On or and after that date, all Apache Indians found outside their reservations will be considered and treated as hostile. Reservations were established at Apache, McDowell, Date Creek, Grant, Verde, Beals Spring, and San Carlos in Arizona and Tularosa, New Mexico, by President Grant's Peace Commissioner, Vincent Collier. This established a defined field of operation. Crook sent messages out to all the Apache bands that they must report to their designated reservations by the middle of February, and any who did not report would be branded as hostiles. Naturally, when spring came and the weather abated, various bands bolted from the reservation. Although many Indians moved to their assigned reservations, thousands preferred to stay free. The raiding, depredations, and killing continued. How were snake bites treated before antivenoms? J.R. Sanders, Yucaipa, California. A common treatment was the ubiquitous cure-all, whiskey. But alcohol only speeds up distribution and absorption of snake venom. Another was the cut and suck, as shown in numerous movies and TV shows. Neither is recommended today. Neither are tourniquets. Still another was to put some gunpowder on the bite wound and light it. When all hope was failing, the victim could hope for a dry bite where little or no venom was injected into the wound. That happened, but not too often.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.